This is the August 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE based on New York State appellate decisions that were released in August of 2020 and were summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website. The summaries, the August summaries have been collected in a pamphlet, the August 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. That pamphlet serves as the written materials for this course, and the page numbers referred to here are the pages in that pamphlet. The first decision is on page 5. It's U.S. Bank National Association. It deals with the acceleration of a debt in a foreclosure action and the court's inability to issue advisory opinions. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the acceleration of the debt had not been revoked by the discontinuance of the foreclosure action, and plaintiff's request for a declaration the acceleration had been revoked, made after the action was discontinued, was an improper request for an advisory opinion. The court wrote, upon discontinuance of the action, a judicial declaration on the issue of whether the plaintiff elected to revoke its acceleration would be merely advisory, inasmuch as there was no active case in which such declaration could have an immediate effect. Indeed, by seeking voluntary continuance of the action, the plaintiff, in effect, waived any right to seek any further judicial relief in the action. In this department, that's the Second Department, a lender's mere act of voluntarily discontinuing an action does not constitute in and of itself an affirmative act revoking an earlier acceleration of the debt. This is a foreclosure action, obviously. This is so because the full balance of the mortgage debt cannot be sought without an acceleration, whereas the voluntary discontinuance of a foreclosure action may be occasioned for any number of different reasons, including those that have nothing to do with an intent to revoke the acceleration. Thus, it is the plaintiff who has authority to revoke its election to accelerate the mortgage debt under the terms of the note, and not the court. So the takeaway here is, in the Second Department, the discontinuance of a foreclosure action does not by itself de-accelerate the mortgage debt, so the 6-year statute of limitation keeps running on any subsequent foreclosure action. And because a discontinuance terminates a court's involvement in the case, no further relief is available in that action because the courts cannot issue advisory opinions. Next is Alexandra R. on page 6. It's an important appeals case, Fourth Department. Refusing to follow any decisions to the contrary, held, despite the defendant's failure to make a motion to set aside the verdict, the appellate court may review the record and render a judgment warranted by the facts. The Fourth Department, over a 2-justice dissent, reversed the plaintiff's verdict in this traffic accident case. Defendant, an employee of the New York State Thruway Authority, was the driver of a dump truck parked on the shoulder of the thruway while other employees picked up debris in the median. The truck was parked 18 inches to the left of the fog line. Plaintiff's van drifted out of its lane and struck the back of the dump truck. The plaintiffs argued defendant was required by the relevant regulations to pull off as far from traffic as possible. The Fourth Department held that although failure to pull off the highway further than 18 inches may demonstrate a lack of due care, it did not demonstrate recklessness as required by the Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1103. So the takeaway here is, at least in the Fourth and Second Departments, a weight of the evidence appellate review is available, whether or not a motion to set aside the verdict was made. Here, no post-judgment motion was made, and the verdict was reversed. Next is Kirchhoff on page 7, dealing with attorney's fees. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant was entitled to attorney's fees pursuant to CPLR 3220. In this breach of contract action. The defendant offered $950,000 to settle the action before trial, and plaintiff was awarded less, $525,000. Court wrote, CPLR 3220 provides, in relevant part, in an action to recover damages for breach of contract, at any time at least 10 days prior to trial, a defendant may make a written offer to allow judgment to be taken against it for a sum therein specified with costs then accrued if the defendant fails in his defense. If the plaintiff rejects the offer and thereafter fails to obtain a more favorable judgment, the plaintiff shall pay the expenses necessarily incurred by the defendant for trying the issue of damages from the time of the offer. Again, that's CPLR 3220. So the takeaway here is CPLR 3220 imposes consequences on the failure to settle a case. Where the settlement offer is higher than the judgment after trial, the plaintiff is liable for the defendant's trial-related expenses, including attorney's fees. Next is Gertler on page 8. It's another attorney's fees case, this time based on the breach of an employment contract. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff was entitled to salary, prejudgment interest, and attorney's fees stemming from plaintiff's employer's breach of a written employment agreement. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 5001, the plaintiff is entitled to statutory prejudgment interest based on the defendant's breaches of the written agreement. For the same reasons that the plaintiff is entitled to prejudgment interest, the plaintiff also established his entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on so much of the second cause of action as sought an award of reasonable attorney's fees under Labor Law Section 198, Subdivision 1-A. So the takeaway here is there are two statutes at work in this breach of an employment contract case. CPLR 5001 provides, quote, interest to verdict, report, or decision shall be recovered upon a sum awarded because of a breach of performance of a contract. And Labor Law Section 198, Subdivision 1A provides, quote, in any action instituted in the courts upon a wage claim by an employee in which the employee prevails, the court shall allow such employee to recover the full amount of any underpayment, all reasonable attorney's fees, and prejudgment interest as required under the civil practice law and rules. Next is the Mann case, M-A-N-N, on page 10. It deals with the pleading requirements for a breach of fiduciary duty, and it also deals with the relationship between a corporation and the attorney representing the corporation. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the pleading requirements for a breach of fiduciary duty cause of action were not met, and the defendant attorneys who represented the corporation, not the decedent, did not owe a fiduciary duty to the decedent. The court wrote, the elements of a cause of action to recover damages for breach of fiduciary duty are 1. The existence of a fiduciary relationship, 2. Misconduct by the defendant, and 3. Damages directly caused by the defendant's misconduct. A cause of action to recover damages for breach of fiduciary duty must be pleaded with the particularity required under CPLR 3016 Subdivision B. Here, the sixth cause of action alleging breach of fiduciary duty contained only bare and conclusory allegations related to damages without any supporting detail and failed to satisfy the requirements of CPLR 3016 Subdivision B. In addition, the complaint alleged that the attorney defendants represented the corporation and therefore owed a fiduciary duty to the decedent based upon the representation of the corporation. However, the decedent was a shareholder or an employee, and a corporation's attorney represents the corporate entity, not its shareholders or employees. So the takeaway here is CPLR 3016 Subdivision B provides, quote, where a cause of action or defense is based upon misrepresentation, fraud, mistake, willful default, breach of trust, or undue influence, the circumstances constituting the wrong shall be stated in detail. So although the language of CPLR 3016 subdivision B is not itself very specific, a breach of fiduciary duty cause of action must be pled with specificity pursuant to the breach of trust language in CPLR 3016 subdivision B. So again, that statute says where a cause of action or defense is based upon a breach of trust, the circumstances constituting the wrong shall be stated in detail. And that is the aspect of the statute which relates to fiduciary duty. Next is Charles Schwab Corporation on page 12. It has to do with a motion to dismiss. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendants, that was Goldman Sachs, motion to dismiss the complaint in this breach of contract action should not have been granted. The issue is whether a contract which is silent about its duration was properly terminated by Goldman. The issue requires consideration of the intent of the parties and could not be resolved based upon the pleadings. The court wrote, Supreme Court failed to examine the surrounding circumstances as well as the intent of the parties in discerning the original intent of the parties. It improperly determined as a matter of law that a reasonable time justifying termination of the contract had elapsed and plaintiffs had not made any persuasive arguments to the contrary. In doing so, it relied upon its conclusion that Goldman was no longer receiving a meaningful benefit from the agreement, thus rejecting out of hand plaintiffs' allegations in the amended complaint to the contrary. As this is a motion to dismiss pursuant to CPLR 3211 subdivision A7, Supreme Court should have afforded the pleadings a liberal construction, taken the allegations of the complaint as true, and afforded plaintiffs the benefit of every possible favorable inference. A motion court must only determine whether the facts as alleged fit within any cognizable legal theory. Whether a plaintiff can ultimately establish its allegations should not be considered in determining a motion to dismiss. Under CPLR 3211 subdivision A1, a dismissal is warranted only if the documentary evidence submitted conclusively establishes a defense to the asserted claims as a matter of law. So the takeaway here is, on a motion to dismiss, the court must accept the allegations in a complaint as true, and the failure to do so mandates reversal on appeal. And it seems like a clear-cut mistake like the one in this case should probably be remedied by a motion to re-argue instead of an expensive appeal. Next is Romine on page 13. It deals with the doctrine of primary jurisdiction. Third Department held the doctrine of primary jurisdiction precluded plaintiff's lawsuit against former officers of the Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corporation. Plaintiff believed a digital encoder receiver transmitter called an ERT installed at his home by the utility to replace an analog meter emitted cancer-causing radiation. Plaintiff removed the ERT and replaced it with an analog meter. The utility considered the meter dangerous and cut off plaintiff's electricity. Plaintiff complained to the Public Service Commission, that's the PSC, which supported the utility's power cutoff and informed plaintiff of his appeal rights. Plaintiff did not appeal and started the instant civil suit. The court wrote, we find that Supreme Court was correct in its interpretation of the doctrine of primary jurisdiction. Under the doctrine of primary jurisdiction, a court has the discretion to refrain from exercising jurisdiction over a matter where an administrative agency also has jurisdiction, and the determination of the issues involved under a regulatory scheme depends upon the specialized knowledge and the experience of the agency. We agree with Supreme Court's determination that review of the PSC ruling is limited to a CPLR Article 78 proceeding. Supreme Court, in determining the motion for summary judgment, properly considered whether the primary jurisdiction doctrine precluded the causes of action propounded by plaintiff, and that in order to review the original ruling, it was incumbent upon plaintiff to bring an Article 78 proceeding. So the takeaway here is obviously the proper vehicle for review of a decision made by an administrative agency is an Article 78 petition, not a new freestanding lawsuit like the civil suit brought here. I haven't run into this issue before, but apparently a court can simply refrain from exercising jurisdiction over a matter that was decided by an administrative agency under the doctrine of primary jurisdiction, deferring to the agency's expertise. A question that comes to mind is, could the court have refrained from exercising jurisdiction if this action had properly been brought under an Article 78? Next is the Dumont case on page 14, dealing with the notice required for expert witnesses. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was no need for the defendants to give prior notification to the plaintiff of the defendant's intent to call one of plaintiff's treating doctors to testify about the cause of plaintiff's cognitive deficits in this traffic accident case. The doctor would have testified the deficits were caused by a prior stroke. The testimony was precluded by Supreme Court because no expert witness notice had been provided to the plaintiff pursuant to CPLR 3101 subdivision D. The plaintiff was awarded $2 million, but the Second Department held the verdict should have been set aside. The court wrote, a treating physician is permitted to testify at trial regarding causation, notwithstanding the failure to provide notice pursuant to CPLR 3101 subdivision D1. Indeed, a plaintiff's treating physician could testify to the cause of the injuries even if he or she had expressed no opinion regarding causation in his or her previously exchanged medical report. Here, the Supreme Court should not have precluded the plaintiff's treating physician from testifying regarding causation based on the defendant's failure to provide notice pursuant to CPLR 3101, as that provision does not apply to treating physicians. So the takeaway here is the requirement that a party must provide notice of the testimony of an expert witness pursuant to CPLR 3101 does not apply to plaintiff's treating physician, who may give an opinion about the cause of plaintiff's injuries, even if causation was not addressed in the doctor's medical records. Next is Katz on page 15, deals with the concept of the law of the case. The Second Department determined a prior appeal in the same matter did not trigger the law of the case doctrine. The court wrote, Supreme Court's determination that certain causes of action should be dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211 was not precluded by this court's determination on a prior appeal that similar causes of action were not palpably insufficient nor patently devoid of merit. The law of the case doctrine applies only to legal determinations that were necessarily resolved on the merits in a prior decision, and to the same question in the same case. On the prior appeal, we determined only that plaintiff's proposed amendments were not so palpably insufficient as to warrant denial of plaintiff's motion to amend. On an ensuing motion to dismiss, however, the standard is whether the facts, as alleged, fit within any cognizable legal theory. Next is the Hunters for Deer case on pages 15 and 16. It deals with preemption, town law versus state law. Second Department held the town ordinance regulating the discharge setback for a bow and arrow was preempted by the conflicting provisions in environmental conservation law, that's ECL section 11-0931. The court wrote, the two statutory provisions employ the same terminology to regulate the same subject matter and demonstrate that the town may not regulate the discharge setback of a bow and arrow in a manner inconsistent with the state law. Next is the city mortgage case on pages 16 and 17. Deals with the criteria for a motion to renew. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to renew his opposition to the bank's motion for summary judgment should have been granted in this foreclosure action. In support of its summary judgment motion, the bank alleged it had standing based upon possession of the note. However, in support of the bank's subsequent motion to confirm the referee's report, the bank submitted a lost note affidavit. The court wrote, a motion for leave to renew shall be based upon new facts not offered on the prior motion that would change the prior determination. That CPLR 2221 subdivision E2. And shall contain reasonable justification for the failure to present such facts on the prior motion, and that's CPLR 2221 subdivision A3. Here, in support of his cross motion for leave to renew, the borrower had a reasonable justification for his failure to present the new facts in opposition to the original motion, since the plaintiff had previously and unequivocally represented that the original note was in its possession, and only later disclosed that the original note had in fact been lost without providing any further details as to when the search for the note occurred, who conducted the search, and when the note was lost. So the takeaway here is, this is a clear example of the proper use of a motion to renew to address new facts that could change the outcome. Here the determination whether the bank had standing to bring the foreclosure action based upon its possession of the note. Next is Bermel on pages 18 and 19. It deals with an at-will employment contract and its relation to the statute of frauds. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that although the employment contract was oral, it was not subject to the statute of frauds until after plaintiff was terminated. The court wrote, General Obligations Law, Section 5-701, Subdivision A1, provides that every agreement, promise, or undertaking is void unless it or some note or memorandum thereof be in writing and subscribed by the party to be charged therewith, or by his lawful agent, if such agreement, promise, or undertaking by its terms is not to be performed within 1 year from the making thereof. Only those agreements which by their terms have absolutely no possibility in fact and law of full performance within 1 year will fall within the statute of frauds. Here, plaintiff was an at-will employee of defendant, and an at-will employment is capable of being performed within 1 year. We therefore reject defendant's contention that the court erred in denying its motion with respect to plaintiff's claim for payment of commissions fixed and earned during the course of plaintiff's employment with defendant. So the takeaway here is just a clear explanation of why at-will employment contracts do not come within the statute of frauds, because it's entirely possible that it will be completed within 1 year. Next is U.S. Bank on pages 19 and 20. It's a statute of limitations case dealing with a foreclosure action and the effect of accelerating the debt in a foreclosure action. When the debt is accelerated, the 6-year statute of limitations begins to run. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the foreclosure action on the entire debt was time barred, but there was a question of fact whether the debt was de-accelerated such that the installment payments due during the 6 years prior to the commencement of the action were recoverable by the plaintiff bank. So the practice pointer here, when a foreclosure action is commenced, the debt is accelerated and the 6-year statute of limitations on the entire debt starts to run. If the initial action is terminated and the debt is de-accelerated before the statute runs, the bank may, in a subsequent foreclosure action, sue for the monthly payments which accrued during the 6 years before the second action. Next is the Stephanie L. case, which is on pages 20 and 21. It's another statute of limitations case, this time dealing with when the statute of limitations on a fraud action accrued. The Fourth Department held the fraud cause of action was not time barred, and the defendants owed a duty which supported the negligence cause of action. The plaintiffs, who had a biological child, took in a foster child through Good Shepherd, a placement service. The plaintiffs were not aware that the foster child had a history of animal abuse and sexually inappropriate behavior. One day after plaintiff's adoption, of the foster child, the child sexually assaulted the biological child. Plaintiff sued in fraud and negligence, and Supreme Court denied Good Shepherd's motion to dismiss. The court wrote, "A defendant's mere knowledge of something is not an element of a fraud cause of action. Instead, a fraud cause of action requires a showing of the false representation of a material fact with the intent to deceive. Even assuming that Good Shepherd knew of the foster child's history of animal abuse and engaging in sexually inappropriate behavior as early as May 2008, we conclude that its knowledge did not demonstrate that the alleged fraud occurred at that time. Good Shepherd submitted no evidence that in May 2008 it falsely represented the foster child's relevant history with the intent to deceive plaintiffs. Thus, it did not establish as a matter of law, that the fraud cause of action accrued in 2008. So here we have the defendant raising the statute of limitations and arguing that the fraud cause of action accrued back in 2008, and the court disagreed. So the practice pointer here, the placement agency was hoping to show that it committed fraud in 2008 so that the fraud cause of action would be deemed time barred, but the court held the placement agency to the pleading requirements for fraud, a false representation of a material fact made with the intent to deceive, of which there was no evidence from 2008, so the statute did not start running then, and the action was not time-barred. Next is the Stonewall Construction case, page 23. It deals with a contractually shortened statute of limitations. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the 90-day statute of limitation in the contract applied, and the breach of contract cause of action was therefore time-barred. The construction contract required an action to be brought within 90 days of the completion of construction. The court wrote, "An agreement which modifies the statute of limitations by specifying a shorter but reasonable period within which to commence an action is enforceable. The period of time within which an action must be brought should be fair and reasonable in view of the circumstances of each particular case. The circumstances, not the time, must be the determining factor. Absent proof that the contract is one of adhesion or the product of overreaching, or that the altered period is unreasonably short, the abbreviated period of limitation will be enforced." And here it was 90 days after the completion of construction. It's enforceable. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code, which should be placed on your attorney affirmation for this August 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is fraud. Again, the verification code for this August 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is fraud. Next is the PASEK, P-A-S-E-K case on pages 23 and 24. It deals with the importance of addressing all the causes of action in a summary judgment motion. Here it's in a medical malpractice case. The Fourth Department noted that the affidavit of plaintiff's expert in this medical malpractice action did not address several of the allegations of defendant's negligence. Therefore, the unaddressed claims were deemed abandoned. The court wrote, "Inasmuch as plaintiff's expert failed to address the claims addressed defendant regarding the diagnosis, consulting, testing, examination, and pre- and post-operative treatment, and did not identify any deviation with respect to defendant's efforts to ventilate, monitor, or resuscitate the plaintiff, those claims are deemed abandoned." So the takeaway here is, when you're dealing with a summary judgment motion, here in a medical malpractice action, if the defense expert adequately addresses the claims made in plaintiff's bill of particulars, and some of those claims are not addressed by plaintiff's expert in opposition, the unaddressed claims are abandoned. And the final case in this August 2020 Civil Procedure CLE update is on page 24, United Specialty Insurance. It deals with the need to present evidence in admissible form in support of a summary judgment motion. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted because the supporting evidence, including an attorney affidavit, was not in admissible form. The court wrote, the affirmation of defendant's attorney was not based upon personal knowledge and thus was of no probative or evidentiary significance. The affidavit or affirmation of an attorney, even if he or she has no personal knowledge of the facts, may, of course, serve as the vehicle for the submission of acceptable attachments which do provide evidentiary proof in admissible form, such as documents and transcripts. Here, however, the submissions by defendant on the motion were not in admissible form. The emails and letters were offered for the truth of their contents and therefore constituted hearsay. Defendant failed to establish that any exception to the hearsay rule applied. Since defendant failed to submit admissible evidence or an affidavit by a person having knowledge of the facts, it failed to establish its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, citing CPLR 3212, subdivision B. So that completes this August 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.